Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's a special live broadcast from the annual Chadwick Arboretum plant sale on the campus of Ohio State University. We'll be here until noon. If you want to join us in person, go to our website at wosu.org/allsides for the directions and more information. The annual plant sale is always a great place to find everything you need for your garden, but it's also a fundraiser for the Chadwick Arboretum and an important way to celebrate National Public Parks Day, which is today, every year on the Friday before Mother's Day. Coming up later, we wouldn't have much of a park or garden anywhere without the honeybee. We'll talk about that crisis, what can be done, and alternative beekeeping. Joining us now to talk about public parks and their importance is Chadwick Arboretum Executive Director Mary Maloney. I should say welcome back to the show, Mary.
Well, thanks, Ann. I appreciate this.
Yeah, we are so lucky today. At 3 o'clock in the morning, we were both in a panic, right? If everyone heard the thunder.
Yeah, I didn't think we were going to be live at the plant sale. I'm very grateful to be here.
And now the sun is shining, right?
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Gary Clark. He's Director of Planning, Horticulture, and Facilities for the Franklin Park Conservatory and Botanical Garden. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you, Ann, and great to be here with Mary again.
Hey, thanks.
So I, to tell you the truth, had never heard of National Public Gardens Day.
Well, we have kind of a mothership called the American Public Gardens Association that all the botanic gardens in the nation belong to, or many, many of them, including Franklin Park Conservatory and Chadwick Arboretum. And they are trying to promote the value of public gardens to the general public. And so that day, I don't know, it came into existence maybe 5 years ago now.
Oh, okay.
And so the American Public Gardens Association helps us promote it. So it's just fabulous that you're on site today. At this plant sale, all these proceeds today will benefit our public garden. So essentially, all these customers are building a public garden in Central Ohio.
And the plant sale is older than 6 years, though. It's been around several years.
The gardens were established in 1981, and we've had plant sales since 1987. And we started out as a very small tabletop operation with two or three tables of plants, and you know, we thought,
who knew?
The volunteers, we now have 180 of them. They work year-round to get this together, and it's fantastic.
It really is fantastic. It's right at the corner of Lane Avenue and
Fred Taylor Drive. Of the Schottenstein Arena. Right. You can't miss it.
And there's lots of free parking across the street as well.
Right.
So no problem there. Gary Clark, what are you doing at the Franklin Park Conservatory?
Well, our big thing right now is the Blooms and Butterfly exhibit. And we do that every year from spring till about Labor Day. And for National Public Gardens Day, that's what we're promoting. And also there's we do daily butterfly releases with an educational program at 1 and 3. There's a butterfly gardening talk at 2 o'clock today, and so we've added a few programs. The reason for National Public Gardens Day being today, the Mother's Day weekend is sort of the traditional kickoff, sort of nationwide, depending on the climate, but it's a great weekend to kind of kick off the gardening season, and so the timing is great. It's also the reason the sale is this weekend, I'm sure.
That's it.
How many people do you expect here?
You know, we think it's about 3,500, but, you know, each time it tends to increase. For example, this morning there was a lot of traffic here at the plant sale. You know, a lot of foot traffic, people buying things for Mother's Day. We have Master Gardeners here, Franklin County Extension Master Gardeners. We have Chadwick Arboretum volunteers, and they're helping even novice plant people find their selections.
There are other sorts of vendors here as well. For instance, Studio West is here. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
We have a horticulture therapy program at Chadwick Arboretum, and each week we have clients who are adults with developmental disabilities come in to do some horticulture therapy with us. And there are actually two tents here. Studio West they bring in artisans with disabilities to create the art.
Beautiful stuff.
It is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I have some of that in my own garden, and it's just it's very dear to me. Also, the Chadwick Arboretum Horticulture Therapy Program. They have some painted pots here that some of the clients help to decorate, and then that generates funds to continue our program.
And then, by the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about the annual plant sale at the Chadwick Arboretum, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. With me right now, Miriam Maloney, Executive Director of the Chadwick Arboretum, and also Gary Clark. He's Director of Planning, Horticulture, and Facilities for the Franklin Park Conservatory and Botanical Gardens. Questions or comments about either, give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, there are other kinds of vendors. Chris Laszlo from Rockbridge is here.
Oh, she is. And she has a lot of botanical products. She makes soaps and bug repellents and chapsticks out of botanicals. Very, very lovely products, and those will make nice Mother's Day gifts as well.
The Arboretum took a bad hit a few years ago, right? Was it a few years ago now, or have I blocked my memory out in a windstorm?
Actually, that was our sister Arboretum in Worcester, Ohio,
the OSU
Seacrest Arboretum, right. And they're here today. They're rebuilding their Arboretum, selling the Buckeye tie-dye shirts.
Oh,
so that's their fundraiser.
Yeah, there they are dancing over there, I see.
Yeah, bringing some. And I think everybody who loves Ohio State University has to get a Buckeye tie-dye T-shirt. It's a beautiful shirt, and it'll help raise funds for Seacrest Arboretum as they rebuild.
Tell us a little bit about the array of plants here today, and Gary, jump in, because you know just as much.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention, it is about buying plants and products here, and that's what. But if you look around, people are talking, and I think National Public Gardens Day, same kind of thing. Gardens aren't anymore just about the plants. It's about sort of social connections and experiences. And so when you look around the sale here, and I've been here many times, you'll see people exchanging information as much as shopping. Of course, we want them to shop.
But people talk about
plants and share their experiences, and I think that's what it's all about.
Sometimes it's seen as a very solitary sort of a hobby, but it's really anything but when you come to a place like this.
I almost disagree. I mean, I think it's nice to work alone in your garden, but... You know, the social interaction. Just here at the sale, we have Franklin County Extension Master Gardeners and the students from Crop and Soil Science Club selling heirloom vegetables and you know, talking to... we have a lot of first-time vegetable gardeners who are returning to the gardens, and those experts down there can help you select the best plants for your garden. And then we have herbs for sale. Mm-hmm. There's annuals, perennials. We're going to begin a tree and plant auction at noon today, and then we'll have another again tomorrow. So there are many, many plant opportunities down here. And if you don't have a garden, you just have a patio, we have patio plants. We have plants for your mother for Mother's Day.
Yeah, annuals, perennials, shade, sun, the whole deal. I noticed last night when I was here for the members' event, they were really pushing the sorrel, and I didn't take any, and I'm sorry now because you also have some recipes out there for sorrel, using sorrel.
There are some culinary herbalists down there staffing the herb area, and, you know, I think everybody goes away with a basil plant and maybe a rosemary, but they'll help you expand your rose garden, especially if you have a culinary inclination. These experts down there can, help set up your herb garden, even if it's a patio garden.
A lot of concerns now about preservation of seeds and diversity and so forth. When you go to the Franklin Park Conservatory, you really get a feel for that, about how diverse things could be, but they're less and less now.
Yeah, and I think what we like at the conservatory is the contrast with Chadwick, also Dawes Arboretum here in Newark, that we offer some of the tropical,
right.
The orchids, the bonsai, and sort of we try to give people a flavor of the world. Maybe if people aren't able to travel, they can come and see plants and kind of get a feel and maybe be inspired to travel. And so the conservation message, very important, and diversity of plants. And so even the average person who's maybe not into gardening, but they can appreciate an orchid show, for example, and bonsai and the unusual plants and kind of maybe get them interested in things.
You know, Anne, in 1992, when we held this major horticulture event here, Ameriflora, that kind of welcomed the world to Columbus, we didn't have a lot of gardens to show them. And as a result of that event, Franklin Park Conservatory, look what's happened to them in the last 10 or 15 years. It's just a pinnacle place in Central Ohio. Chadwick Arboretum went from 14 acres to its 60 acres. Inniswood developed. The herbs at Gantz, gardens at Gantz Farm down in Grove City. The Rose Park at Whetstone was renovated and expanded, and now they're moving towards Earthkind roses. You know, the protocol that does away with fertilizers, pesticides, and additional irrigation. So I think we're all in a, you know, expansion mode in a very conscious way about the way we have to present our collections now.
There is a section that's devoted to native plants.
Yes. And actually here at the plant sale, the Plant Pathology Graduate Student Association is providing a huge array of native plants that they're selling. Plants that will attract butterflies and desirable insects to your garden, and also provide a lot of color. So, you know, those students know a great deal about the plants they're selling. Very drought tolerant. You remember last summer was a terrible drought year.
I think a big movement towards the native plants. What I like to look at, and we haven't done a lot yet at Franklin Park, is use the native plants but in a more designed way. Masses, large sweeps. So it doesn't have to look like a native garden. There are some rain gardens where you need to do that, but in the future I'd like to do some really bold gardens but are based on native plants, and I think that would be pretty interesting.
You know, I was just talking with those students in plant pathology this morning, and I said, you know, you're right across from the very colorful blooming baskets. What will compel people to come into your booth with just the green plants? And I said, you have to talk about it. You have to say, see this plant? It's a nitrogen fixer. Do you know what that means? Mm-hmm. You know, how will this benefit your garden? This is an asclepia that will attract butterflies. It'll be a way station for the migrating butterflies, and it'll be a beautiful plant in your garden. So, anyway.
No, that's great. I mean, it is. It's great. You go from table to table, and it tells you what you're looking at and what this plant and this group of plants can be used for. There is a whole section on butterflies, attracting butterflies and hummingbirds.
Yeah, and I think, obviously, master gardeners know a lot of this information, but the average homeowner that I've met doesn't know a great deal about gardening. They want to do it, and I think there's a little bit of a gap there in terms of how do you bridge that, where to plant a tree properly, how do you plant bulbs, what are native plants for, and I think maybe we can pull, you know, more education together to help people. I think people want to garden, for sure.
I think it's ongoing, and certainly the expansion of the sort of local gardens, the community gardens that are showing up in many, many parts of town here. I was just driving by the Whetstone Library the other day, and they had some container gardens out there where the community is.
Yes.
This is where we borrow our library books, and this is where we do our aerobics, and it's also where we're going to grow some fresh vegetables.
Right out front.
Right.
Yeah, I noticed that this morning.
And I love that. I hate that, you know, sort of the vegetable garden is traditionally relegated to the backyard, and I love the integration of edibles and ornamentals right in the front yard.
Yeah, our front yard faces north, unfortunately, so our vegetable garden is right smack in the middle of our backyard where the sun is.
Yeah, well, you know.
But I get your point.
Yes,
very well.
Yes, right plant, right location.
That's
right,
it.
Exactly.
You know, we're having a huge paradigm shift in Columbus. Gary and I have kind of in the last 19 years, you know, maybe you're 19 or 20 years at Franklin Park.
Yep.
And, you know, how horticulturally how things have changed in Columbus, Ohio. He mentioned the Franklin County Extension Master Gardener Program. Mm-hmm. The first class was trained in 1993.
Wow.
Now we have many, many master gardeners doing projects throughout the city. It's a fabulous group of educated volunteers.
Before we leave off, I wanted you to tell me there is an interesting connection between Gary Clark and the Arboretum. And
right.
Tell me that, because I can't remember what you were saying, but it sounds like an interesting trip, too.
Well, Gary, when he was a young horticulture student, interned for a year at Blooms of Bressingham in England. He's from England.
Yes. Yeah. Still.
Still. Oh, well, there you have it. So, and we were fortunate at Chadwick Arboretum some few years ago to have Adrian Bloom come and install a 5,500 square foot garden, one of his signature gardens. And then this August now, Chadwick Arboretum is leading a tour to the Blooms of Bressingham Gardens, and we'll be with Adrian Bloom a couple days in addition to visiting many gardens in England.
And just a phenomenal trip. They're actually going to spend 2 days doing workshops hands-on with Adrian Bloom. And if you don't know Adrian Bloom, he's sort of the rock star of horticulture in England. He has all the medals.
His father, a rock star of a place that worships horticulture.
Right, exactly. And we were fortunate he was here last year also. We hosted the American Public Gardens Association annual conference in Columbus, and Adrian Bloom was a featured speaker. And it was just a wonderful event. He was back here at Chadwick. And talking to him about his gardens and these tours that he's put together, they just look amazing, I think. And I wish I could go. I had too many other trips this year.
You know, it's a wonderful collaboration. I know Luke Messinger, the executive director out at Dawes Arboretum in Newark, and Gary and myself, we've talked about, just getting over there, the three of us.
Right.
So I'm finally going to get there. I've never been to Blooms. I've been to England many times, so I'm looking forward to this tour.
Once again, another way for horticulture lovers to spend time together. I want to thank you today, now, for being with us today and joining us at the annual plant sale at the Chadwick Arboretum. Mary Maloney, Executive Director of the Chadwick Arboretum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Anne. This is an honor.
And thanks for having us, I should say, as well.
I hope you come back every year and help us celebrate National Public Gardens Day.
We will come back every year. And Gary Clark, Director of Planning, Horticulture, and Facilities for Franklin Park Conservatory, thanks for joining us, Gary.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening right now. We're going to be back. We're going to be talking about bees. There's a problem, and we're going to find out maybe how the rest of us can help fix it. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, thanking WOSU and others who make Columbus a smart and open community. At the Columbus Foundation, personal service and community pride combine to help donors help others through impactful philanthropy, big or small. It's here that history resounds and opportunity abounds.
The American food machine feeds nearly 300 million people every day. Sunday afternoon on WOSU-TV, meet the men and women who keep us fed, from modern-day cowboys to the pizza deliverymen. It's four special episodes of America Revealed, beginning with The Food Machine, Sunday afternoon at 4 on WOSU-TV.
Support comes from the Center for Business Analytics in the University of Cincinnati Lindner College of Business, presenting Analytics Summit 2013, May 31st, with keynote address by Tom Davenport, author of the book Competing on Analytics. Information at 513-556-7140.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have a special edition 2-hour live remote broadcast at the 2013 Chadwick Arboretum plant sale near Ohio. Well, it's right on the grounds of the Ohio State University, really. For more information or to attend the plant sale, you can visit our website at wosu.org/allsides for a link to their website. According to a new survey of America's beekeepers, almost a third of the country's honeybee colonies did not make it through the winter. And that's a downturn that has repeated every year since the U.S. Department of Agriculture began its annual survey 6 years ago. So what's the problem, and what can we do to help? That's what we're going to talk about now. Welcome to a special live broadcast once again from the annual Chadwick Arboretum plant sale. If you have a question or comment about bees, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Joining us now to talk about the honeybee problem and why it's about more than the honey we consume is Dr. James Tu. Dr. Tu is a retired OSU professor. He's a beekeeping specialist for the Alabama Cooperative Extension System, Auburn University. He writes a monthly article for Bee Culture magazine and is the author of two books, Beekeeping Principles and Backyard Beekeeping. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very kindly.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture annual survey of bees was only started 6 years ago, and I was kind of surprised to read that. Is there any reason to believe that that drop-off in bees predates 6 years ago?
Yes, there is reason to believe that. 6 years ago, it came to such a level of awareness that bees are gone, and beekeepers are struggling keeping their bees that are alive, still alive, that increasingly governmental agencies, universities, beekeeping groups all became more active, and this became more visible, and the public became more aware.
How many kinds of honeybees are there out there?
There's not but one honeybee in this country, and it's not native to this country. We brought it here in the 1600s to pollinate the early crops and plants that we also brought from England. So the honeybee is not a native insect to anywhere in the Americas.
Is it possible that that could be part of the problem?
Well, we have spent so much time selecting, breeding across the world until, sure, it could be part of the problem, but it's not high on the list.
Yeah. So what are the theories about what's causing the die-offs?
We had a very vicious, new, predaceous mite that attacked our bees beginning about 1984 or so, Varroa. And fundamentally, I can't speak for most apicultural scientists, but I'm comfortable saying that many of those scientists think that this new parasitic mite, new to us and new to our bees, is at the core cause of what's causing all of this.
And what does the mite do?
The mite feeds on the blood of developing bees, and then during the winter months, it feeds on the membranes between the bee parts and takes a blood feast there, so the bees are weakened by this constant blood loss. But more serious than that is that they vector secondary viral invaders, and the viruses that they vector are just terrible.
Are there, are bees only kept domestically? I mean, are they only kept now, or are they out there in the wild too?
Another good question. There used to be a dependable, significant wild population of honeybees. This is confusing because all honeybees are wild.
Right.
Even the wild ones just agree to live in our white boxes.
Exactly.
But they're still wild.
Right.
But that wild population that's not managed, it's gone. It's really decimated. So
it's not from the beekeepers. It's not probably something that happened because of the domestication of the bees.
No, the bees are not domesticated. To this day, they're still wild.
Well, the managed bees, I should say. Yep. It's like...
Okay, this is getting better and better. There's two types of bees.
Okay.
One is the one I keep in my backyard, and I love them, and I look at them every day, and I drink coffee while I stand beside them. And the others are semi-loads of bees that are trucked all across the country for commercial pollination of almonds and commercial crops. That population of bees has worked very hard, and possibly some of our management expectations of that group of our bees is in question.
I heard that they say that there are these crops are dependent on these bees that are moved around like that.
Yep.
Almonds, blueberries.
Name anything. Watermelons, melons, berries, cherries, pears, apples.
And it has to work that way because there aren't enough in the wild anymore.
Modern agriculture, no disrespect to modern agriculture, it's certainly productive. But these large spanses of acreage don't offer diversity that bees need, so we can take in supplemental populations of bees.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's a special edition, two-hour live remote broadcast at the 2013 Chadwick Arboretum Plant Sale at the Ohio State University. For more information or to attend the plant sale yourself, it goes on tomorrow as well. You can visit our website at WOSU.org /allsides and check out the link to their website. So the bee population, besides the fact that there are these parasitical problems, among others perhaps, the bee population has not been able to keep up with anyways the amount of agriculture it's expected to pollinate.
Yep. Some of the probable reasons besides this mite are genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Nutrition, we've changed things a lot. We spray a lot more herbicides and cut grass and string trim, and so there's not as much weed species as there used to be. So maybe nutrition's an issue. Pesticide use could be certainly on the list, and what we're doing unintentionally that hurts bees. So there's some mix of these four or five potential solutions that somewhere in there is an answer.
I want to bring in another guest right now, Don Combs of Mockingbird Meadow Farms, honey and herb farm in Marysville. Dawn has a BA in botany. She's a practicing herbalist and an experienced sustainable beekeeper. Welcome to the show, Dawn.
Thank you, Ann.
So what is sustainable beekeeping? How does that contrast and compare to, I guess, the conventional?
We kind of turn conventional on its head. Sustainable beekeeping, in my mind, should mean that the bees are able to take care of themselves, and we're making the environment that they're in conducive to that.
So what is it about the environment that's not conducive that we have to manage to do to achieve that?
Our focuses on our farm are the health of the bee first and foremost. So we're talking about viruses and mites in the problems of the conventional beekeeping. Those are a problem. We don't focus on those. You can't hardly find mites in our hives at all. And we've had 100% survivability over this year. So our numbers are very different. We focus on the health of the bee first. If they're strong and healthy, then just like us, we can exist with bacteria and viruses nearby on our skin just fine. But if we're weak, that's a problem. It's the same thing with the mite and the viruses in the hive. If the bees aren't strong and healthy, there's a problem.
Dr. Tu, what happens when a beekeeper finds the mite? What do they do?
Well, the mites are there.
No matter what?
No matter what, they're there. And so beekeepers across the country now are deciding what plans they're going to use to control this thing. Dawn's got a system that works for her. Other beekeepers would do other things. And so mm-hmm. there is no standard beekeeper as such right now while this evolution goes on.
Okay. Let's take a call now from Chris in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks very much. This is a very important topic. I'm getting a little echo. It's a little hard.
Okay, do you want to turn off your radio?
My radio's off. It's coming back from my earphone, so your radio.
okay, well, do your best.
I just wanted to say that I wrote an undergraduate biology paper on colony collapse disorder, and I think there's a very good evidence to suggest that this is a syndrome. It's not related to any one cause, and as one of your guests just mentioned, it's the cumulative stresses on the bees that are making them unable to deal with what normally are natural problems. And I would just like to advocate to the general listening public that we all should be using far less household chemicals, detergents, pesticides, cleaners. All of these manufacturers offer recommended amounts that are much more than you really need. And it's the cumulative runoff from a lot of these household chemicals that is contributing to the degradation and fragmentation of bees' natural habitat. So I know some people think there's nothing they can do, but we can all use a little bit less of these toxic chemicals that are contributing to this problem. If we lose the pollinators, they are the canary in the coal mine. If we lose the pollinators, we are sunk.
Dr. Jim, too?
I don't disagree with you. It was Chris, right?
Yes,
Chris.
Chris, I don't disagree with you at all. I'm Jim, too. There is a lot of this unintentional intoxication of bees, and we don't fully understand it. We've got some young scientists now that are just beginning to look at what happens when bees collect benign chemicals from the wild, and then bring them back and homogenize all these things inside the hive. They make this sometimes unintentional concoction that can be remarkably toxic. So this is a bold new area, and I think you're probably as right as anybody can be that this needs no more respect and exploration.
Thanks a lot, Chris, for your call. We appreciate it. We heard about colony collapse disorder a few years ago, where otherwise healthy colonies just suddenly collapsed. But now bees are just leaving their hives, abandoning them. There's a distinction there. Dawn, have you had any problem with that?
Nope. Okay. We don't have those kinds of issues. We really ensure that we see the comb inside the hive as their soil. We ensure that their soil is healthy at all times.
But for Jim, too, any thoughts about that? What the difference is?
From bees that just abscond, just take off.
They just abandon, yeah.
Well, that's a different biological procedure in bees, and it can be brought on by other things. But I want to say that this colony collapse disorder is a syndrome. We're not really sure what it is. You got to call it something.
We're not sure what it, okay.
And so it's different things to different people. But in general, these bees are not where they should be. They're either partially gone or all gone. And so, no, I on occasion, they could all leave in this absconding behavior, but in general, they just kind of peter away. The bees are not there. There's a few left. A dejected queen. These bees are not going to survive the winter.
I thought it was interesting when I was reading about it that they dwindle, and then it gets to a point, there's a tipping point, where they can't generate the heat they need to produce the brood.
Nicely
Am I
read,
using the words right?
Yep.
No, that's exactly right. There's about 400 bees is the absolute minimum that can conduct affairs as a colony. And they really have to make preparations for the winter. The winter season is the season to get through for bees.
I want to invite James from Dublin on. Hi, James, you're on the air. I'm interested in your question because I'm wondering how this kind of an issue might contribute to these larger issues that we're talking about. Welcome to the show, James.
My question was that trying to be as minimally disruptive to the bee population as possible. I've got carpenter bees that are just absolutely attacking my deck. And I'm curious if there is some way to, without killing, killing off the population, to get them to leave my house.
And I, to add on to that, wonder, when we do things to get rid of other kinds of bees, does that affect the honeybees?
Carpenter bees and honeybees probably compete in a friendly way for resources. And carpenter bees are native, and carpenter bees are the bad child of the bee world. They're good
the
pollinators. They do good things for plants, but they really wear out welcome when they start drilling holes in your houses. And those nests almost have to be individually treated. If you're lucky enough that they're going for a single fascia board or a specific area of the house that can be replaced, then just replace that lumber to see if it'll come up with something that's not as attractive. Paint it heavily if it's stained. Painting can help. If those bees are just crazy for what they're doing there, though, they'll drill through that too. And I really am reluctant to say take them out, but at some point, if they're just more than you can tolerate, quietly take them out.
Okay, James, thanks. Thanks for the question. What about other pesticides we might be using? Are there any particular pesticides that are that we're using to get rid of other kinds of pests that are particularly harmful to bees?
Any of them are a problem.
Okay.
I know, speaking to some of the chemical companies out in my area, I asked if they had plans on talking to the beekeepers before they were spraying those things, and their response was, well, the only thing that matters is the pesticides. When we spray a lot of fungicides with our thing, is what they were saying, and that doesn't hurt the bees at all. That's an unfortunate misconception. They take all that stuff back. They walk on it. They carry it back. They walk it through their brood chamber. They walk it through the honey. They live in that, and eventually their environment gets incredibly toxic. So all of the chemicals that we're spraying on our plants when things are blooming are affecting the bees.
Off topic just slightly, but Jim, too, you mentioned earlier that when you get up, you like to go out in your backyard and have your cup of coffee with your bees. Do you protect yourself at all when you do that?
No, I don't protect myself, but I'm not a hero, but I've done this a lot, and you know when to run if something goes wrong. But in general, if the bees are unmolested during the night, there wasn't a skunk or a raccoon there harassing them, you can stand there and commune with them and nature. But if something has upset them, they can be very testy. But if they are testy, you're going to know it straight away.
Okay, we're going to continue our conversation about bees. Just want to remind you that this is a special edition. It's a live two-hour broadcast at the 2013 Chadwick Arboretum Plant Sale at The Ohio State University. For more information or to attend the plant sale, which continues tomorrow, you can visit our website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll have a link there with more information. With me on the show right now, Dr. Jim Tu, he's a beekeeping expert, and also Don Combs of Mockingbird Meadow Farms. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we don't just interview influential people, we challenge them. Here's noted natural foods advocate Michael Pollan on the subject of ring dings.
I would look at the package next time. That creamy is not cream. Well, you know what? You may know a lot about food, but you don't know the first thing about living, buddy.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the delicious news quiz that's no good for you at all.
Saturday mornings at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. Your annual support of 89.7 NPR News is our largest source of income. Your gifts make up the funds we use to pay for the news you listen to every day. It's easy to renew your 89.7 NPR News membership. Visit us online at wosu.org/renew, call 866-897-9678, or respond to our mailing by sending a generous check. Your annual gift provides us with the foundation of listener support. Thank you for renewing your membership with 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with a 2013 wellness series. Heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's wellness series are at go.osu.edu/series.
This is 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, bringing you local and national news 24/7 and always streaming at wosu.org.
Welcome back to our special edition live remote broadcast at the 2013 Chadwick Arboretum Plant Sale at Ohio State University. For more information or to attend the plant sale yourself, which continues tomorrow, you can visit our website at wosu.org/allsides for a link with more information. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the honeybee problem right now. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also use our Facebook page to post your question or comment. With us right now, Don Combs of Mockingbird Meadows Farms, where they practice sustainable beekeeping. And also Dr. Jim Tu, he's a beekeeping expert, a retired professor from Ohio State University, among other things, and an author. If you have a question or comment for either of them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We have a listener on site who had a question. They ask, are native pollinators being affected too?
Yes, they are.
And tell us what they mean by native pollinators.
Native pollinators are anything that's not a honeybee. It's something that lived here first. Bumblebees, those carpenter bees I talked about, leafcutter bees, mining bees. There's just thousands of these little bees, and they live a quiet life of desperation, pollinating locally and working. And I love honeybees, but more often than not, honeybees get credit for what these smaller bees are doing.
And I can definitely say, too, on our farm, we're on small acreage, and so we were concerned with the amount of bees that we were keeping in that area that we would crowd out. The honeybee is a very greedy pollinator.
Okay.
That we would crowd out native pollinators. But actually, it's been just the opposite. With our practices and the way we keep the land and our bees, we have seen huge increases in native pollinators over the years.
How do you keep the land?
We are biodynamic, so that means a lot of important things with soil practice. We look at the soil as the most important thing. We keep it healthy. We use composting practices.
So the things that you're growing in the soil that the bees are pollinating.
The soil is healthy, okay. So the plant is able to uptake all of the proper nutrition. The plant is healthy. The plant is fully able to be nutritive to the bee. We are raising medicinal herbs as well as food, so there is a wide variety of things. That's really important. Jim was talking about the monocrop pollinating that's going on, driving them on semis. And, you know, cucumbers are really healthy. But if you eat nothing but cucumbers, you're really sick. We don't look at the bee as collecting a multitude of different nutritional aspects in the honey. We think she just collects honey. And that's all she needs is honey.
Interesting.
It's carbohydrates. It's protein. It's vitamins and minerals. And she knows what she's doing when she's stocking her pantry. But we don't.
A related question from the same listener, can any native species of pollinators be farmed to substitute for European honeybees? James, too?
They probably could be over time. But right now, we've got so much invested over the years with honeybees. We culture them. They agree to be in our boxes. Other bees, we can do it with bumblebees to a degree, but not to the same degree. Bumblebees just don't want to live in our boxes as readily.
Well, and likewise, to what extent is the fact that honeybees produce honey part of the equation, too? I mean, they not only pollinate, but they produce something that we like to eat.
No, the honey was the reason in the earliest years. And ironically, beeswax. Yeah. People wanted beeswax for candles when there was no electricity for nighttime illumination. So, yeah, over time, under any great need, something could be worked out. But right now, most bees, native bees, don't really care for artificial domiciles.
I would hate to see us try and do that to another species just because we don't want to look at the real problem that's going on with the honeybees. It's just another Band-Aid. Let's figure out, let's look at the focus, let's focus on the health of the bee, fix it, and move on from there.
Let's take a call from William in Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome, William.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fisher. I apologize. I got to the program late, so I didn't. It may have been discussed earlier, but I was curious from Ms. Combs, I believe. What is the specific methodology that she uses to keep 100% restoration of her colony each year? I heard Dr. Pooh mention that different people had different methods, but what's the specific method that keeps these animals healthy in her colony and yet dying in other places?
Specifically on our farm, we do a mixture of herbal therapies as well as biodynamic practices in the hives.
And what do you mean by herbal therapies?
If I have a problem, I look at the hive as a holistic individual. I make sure that they're not stressed in any way, which is what's causing the disease or the stress or the bug. If I need to relieve a symptom, then I'm going to use an herbal tea or an herbal smoke or an herbal spray on that. I don't use any chemicals in the hives. We don't use chemicals on the property. We allow them to make their own comb. We never break up the brood chamber. There is a long list of practices that we do, and we're training people to do it now.
Is the sort of thing you do, your methodology, something that can be replicated on a very large scale, though? Like some of the big beekeepers do?
I believe that a lot of it could be replicated, yes. The problem is that you have to change. You cannot focus on incredibly high yields over the health of the bee. We do run a honey business. We do sell our honey. We're also a bee sanctuary. We are making money from that honey, but sometimes those two things kind of conflict. So long as you're willing to put the health first, then the honey needs to come second, the profit needs to come second. And that could conflict with the way that the conventional beekeeping industry is being run right now. But that's not to say that it can't change.
Jim, too, any thoughts about that?
Well, I think Dawn is right. But it'd be difficult. I was thinking as you were talking about some of these commercial guys with 25, 30,000 colonies, they're buying corn syrup and tanker load lots. And they're feeding tons and tons of supplemental protein sources. So this would be a paradigm shift. So it takes people like Ms. Combs who are starting, developing, working out protocols for this. And then as this grows to a greater audience, these fellows would see. I say fellows, I guess, and others too. If there's any attribute of it they could employ full time.
We want to show
big
that
output.
We took a hit when we first started these protocols because we are feeding only their honey. We hold back a large portion of our harvest to feed them.
Huh.
And when we first did that, obviously we took a hit
financially.
In the pocketbook.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is why we've set up a sustainable beekeeping co-op now to make it financially possible for people to do that. But when we took that hit, we eventually found that because the bees were then living, we didn't have the financial output to replace the bees. Hmm. The money that we were taking a hit on and using their own honey to feed them actually is lower now that we've gotten rolling than what it would be to replace the bees all the time.
William, thanks for that call. I wanted to talk very quickly about habitat, and I wanted to bring Mary Maloney back in to the conversation, too. Mary Maloney, Executive Director of the Chadwick Arboretum here, where we're at right now at a live remote broadcast, a special broadcast of All Sides with Ann Fisher. Then I want to get to a few calls quickly. But habitat, we can't change the fact at this point, or a lot of people believe we can't change the fact that we have reduced the kinds of crops that are out there. However, on an individual basis, Mary Maloney, we can make a difference. One of the problems is we're not planting enough native plants. We're not planting enough plants that honeybees or anything can pollinate. Can you talk about that just a little bit, Mary, and what you've done at the plant sale to tell people about that and what they can do?
Well, at the Chadwick Arboretum Spring Plant Sale, we have the Plant Pathology Graduate Student Association here. They've been vending here for many years, and they grow a lot of native plants. That booth is a very popular place for those who know what they're looking for. And I think that there's plenty of opportunities at this event to educate, to begin to educate people about plants that they do need to include in their home landscape that can help, you know, provide habitat for bees and for desirable insects. And it also adds color and diversity to their landscapes. And typically the native plants are also more drought tolerant, and they don't require the pesticides and the fertilizers that a lot of our cultivated plants do.
Which is another issue. The drought was a big hit last year.
We need to start changing the way our perception of beauty in a garden too. Queen Anne's lace and dandelion and a lot of the things that we consider very bad, ugly weeds are incredibly important. If we've just let those things bloom, that doesn't require us watering. We don't care whether it's a drought. They're going to be able to produce for the bees and the native pollinators. You can companion plant with them along with your beautiful perennials, but sometimes it's not pulling the things that we're pulling that would help.
That's right. And I think, you know, a lot of the plant societies like the Rosarians, those who grow the roses, there's a huge paradigm shift going on right now to this Earthkind protocol that disallows fertilizers and pesticides, and the way that the soil is prepped to engage the new plants is, you know, there's no additional irrigation. It's a very sustainable way. When you think of a crop like roses, you just think of, you know, intensity and pesticide application. And so it's, I don't know, we have a large research component in our learning gardens in front of Hallett Hall that with the emphasis on Earthkind protocol growing roses.
Jim, too, just big picture, could we lose all of our honeybees?
I don't think we're going to lose all of them, but we're on a downward decline. In 1948, we had 6 million colonies in the U.S. Today, we have 2.5 million. And so, and we're from that remaining 2.5 million, we're expecting to feed a disproportionately increased agricultural commodity source group. So we're kind of close to not being able to meet our own pollination needs.
And what happens then if we lose our honeybees?
Well, it wouldn't be like you get up one day and these bees are gone. So over time, the cost for individual bees to be taken into orchards would continually increase. It's up to anywhere from $175, $150, $200 now. So there would be a slow increase in commodity prices, maybe faster than slow. And you'd see that first. But unless it's just some late night movie, the bees wouldn't just vanish overnight. So it kind of trickled down, and we'd try to use other bees. We would try to use other crops in that interim. And over time, we would just slowly lose it.
I there are people like our farm. There are people that are bringing, showing success with preventing that from happening. I don't think we have to get too dire and think that it's going to be the end. I think we will be able to fix it, but it's going to take a lot of conscious effort on gardeners' parts, on maybe some of the conventional farming changing, some of the conventional beekeeping for sure changing, and small people like us.
More and more. I'm going to take a real quick call from Linda in Westerville. Hi, Linda. We're running out of time, but I wanted to catch you.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I live in Westerville. I have a third of an acre, and I would love to have some bees, but my neighbor to the left of me is a Roundup queen, and the new neighbor to the right of me wants to make his lawn look like a golf course. Am I in a good area to do that or not?
I live in the middle of conventional agriculture. And my bees are doing really great. I don't live on an island in Hawaii, so it can be done. You just have to care for their hive and their property really, really well.
Jim, too?
That's true. They're going to forage over, if you had bees on your third of an acre, they're going to forage over about the surrounding 18,000 acres. They could productively do that. So whatever your neighbors are immediately doing on either side, it isn't really going to be the big picture. So give it a shot if you still want to do it, and you can convince your neighbors it's a good thing to have bees on your place.
What is the liability exposure for the children that might be stung in the neighborhood? Would I be...
Linda, but...
Their immune system will be benefited. It's great for you.
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you keep bees in your backyard?
I do keep bees in my backyard, and you do want to do commonsensical things. You want maybe a fence around them to require them to gain altitude so that the kids can't get to them. You wouldn't keep a vast number of bees on a third of an acre, one or two, three colonies maximum. Check with Westerville. Check with surrounding beekeepers and see that. Be certain there's no ordinance. So,
okay. All right. Mary Maloney, do you have something quick to add there?
I was going to say we had beehives in Chadwick Arboretum some few years ago, and, you know, that was the – we had to go through OSU Legal to – and I thought, how can you legislate a bee sting, you know, or something? Anyway.
Prove it. Yeah.
And to me, it's hand-in-hand, part and parcel to the garden. You want to have bees where you have your gardens.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, right, I want to remind everybody that we have our, this is a special edition of All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's a live remote broadcast at the 2013 Chadwick Arboretum Plant Sale at Ohio State University. It continues on today, tomorrow. For more information or to attend the plant sale, you can visit our website at wosu.org/allsides for a link to their website. I want to thank as well Don Combs of Mockingbird Meadows Farms in Marysville. Don, how much acreage do you have?
3.5.
3.5 acres. Okay.
Very small.
And how much honey do you produce?
Oh, boy. It really, really varies. We have about 32 hives.
Okay. And Dr. Jim, too, thanks to you as well, beekeeping specialist for the Alabama Cooperative Extension System of Auburn University, retired professor at Ohio State. Thanks again.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, we're going to have Ohio's Garden Sage, Deborah Kanapke, join us. So if you want to queue up those questions or comments, you can. 614-292-8513. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.